Dr. Jerry, you got the whole world waiting. Been ready for you to start the conversation. Your point of view, it got the haters confused. Leave it up to you to bring us all the good news. Positive vibes and the sex appeal too. Dr. Andre Jerry, can I get an interview? Hello and welcome to another episode of Live with Dr. Andre Jerry, your destination for bold conversations, unfiltered truth, and practical inspiration to help you unlock your best life. I'm your host, Dr. Andre Jerry, broadcasting live from San Juan, Puerto Rico. And tonight's show is sponsored by Amazon Autos, because spending 6 hours at the car dealership is so 2005. With Amazon Autos, you can browse, buy, and boom, your new ride shows up at your door. So stick around. We'll hear more about our sponsor during the break. But for now, let's go ahead and get into tonight's conversation. So many of you listening may have parents or grandparents who are getting up there in age, and they may still be doing pretty well for themselves, but you may be quietly wondering about what type of care they may eventually need a few years from now. Some of you may already be in the thick of it and may be already managing care for a parent that has dementia or some other type of serious illness, all while trying to juggle your own career and your own family and your own sanity. And here's a question that most families don't want to face. Do you have a clear plan in place for your loved one's final wishes? I'm talking about the type of care that they want, you know, the medical treatments they do or don't want, how the finances are going to be handled, and yes, even burial arrangements. I know it's a tough conversation, and we avoid it a lot, oftentimes until it's too late, but having that plan in place can be the difference between chaos and clarity, and between having a family conflict and having family peace. So my guest tonight is here to help us navigate some of these questions and a lot more. Dennis Lombardo is a certified end-of-life doula. She's a Willow end-of-life educator, a dementia practitioner, published author, an advocate with over 24 years of experience in guiding families through one of life's most difficult seasons. Her work moves families from fear to preparation, and from chaos to clarity, bridging the gaps in hospice and palliative care while offering the compassion and practical tools caregivers need the most. Dennis has been a recurring guest here on the Artist First Radio Network, having recently appeared on the Harriet Tramer's popular show, Aging Without Wrinkles. And she's been a featured guest on numerous other podcasts and panels and other speaking events. And she brings both a professional expertise and a deeply personal experience as a primary giver for her own father and aunt. She knows the challenges firsthand, and that's why I'm excited to have her on tonight's show, because she's going to share her insights, her resources, and strategies that you can use to help prepare, plan, and protect what matters most. So, Janice Lombardo, welcome to Live with Dr. Andre Jerry. So glad to have you on.
Well, thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here. I'm so happy that you are willing to talk about this, because we all need to be prepared. And like I decided to, you know, go through a long, long time ago, and because I've been a primary caregiver for several elderly family members over the last 24 years, and there are things that you just cannot understand that are going to pop up. And if you have no support or you have no resources, it can make that journey incredibly difficult, chaotic, and very unpleasant for a caregiver at this point in time.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And that's why I've really been genuinely looking forward to this conversation tonight. And not because it's a glamorous topic or anything like that, but it's one of the most important conversations that families and caregivers need to be having right now. I was just talking with a friend, you know, talking about how we all lived through one of the most devastating pandemics of our lifetime. COVID didn't just take millions of lives, including my mother's, but it also exposed how unprepared a lot of families are to handle, you know, the realities of end-of-life decisions and medical care, final wishes, all the stuff that comes along with having to make those types of decisions. And the result for a lot of them has been a lot of confusion, stress, heartache, on top of having to deal with grief. So that's why I'm so grateful to have you on here tonight. And you've coined a phrase that you often use in your interviews and in your marketing materials, which is, you plan for birth, now let's plan for all of life too. And I love that quote. I'd love for you to unpack that a bit and tell us what it means. And in your own words, why this conversation we're having tonight is so important for families and caregivers.
Well, thank you so much. You know, growing up, we didn't talk about dying, death, illness. You had a family member or a loved one pass away. You went to the funeral, and then life just kind of carried on as usual. Grief was not something that was really acknowledged, or, you know, what do you do to help somebody through that process? So when I was younger and going through having my own children, I learned, unfortunately, the hard way about what happens if you don't really plan for birth, or if the plans that you have don't exactly work out as well as you would have hoped. So when my mom's cancer journey started in 2003, and I and my father were her primary caregivers, I was also raising two school-age children at the time, so I was a sandwich generation parent. Mm. And there were so many things that I did not know. And before my mother was actually diagnosed, I had my own cancer journey that I'm really lucky to still be here. And so I made up my mind at that point in time that I was going to do everything in my power to be prepared, to make sure that I did the research, make sure that when I had my daughter, I had a birthing doula, which was still something that really was not popular at the time, and you had to pay for those services out of pocket. But after the experience I had with my son, I wasn't going to go in by myself. I wanted an advocate. I wanted somebody who would be able to talk doctor speak, so to speak, while still supporting me and making sure that I didn't go through what I did with birth of my son. So after my mom passed away in 2011, I thought I was going to be a nurse. And so I started courses to get into nursing school. And then that didn't pan out. Something else came up. And about 2-3 weeks before the pandemic hit and shut everything down, I was actually going to drive to Michigan, I'm in Ohio, for a 4-day intensive to become trained as an end-of-life doula, because everything that I had read about it and was taught about it was just, it made so much sense and it really spoke to me. And because of our healthcare system for many years, it isn't just a new issue. This has been going on for a really long time. I did not want another family member or myself to go through a chronic illness or a sudden illness or accident or whatever and not be prepared. So when I started this journey in March of 2020, I took coursework online and got my certification that way, because obviously I wasn't going to be driving to Michigan when everything was shut down. So I felt that a message that would resonate with folks, because a lot of people do know what a birthing doula is. They still don't know what an end-of-life doula is.
Right.
So that's why my tagline is, you plan for birth. Now let's plan for all of life, too, because that's, like I said, our religions mostly do not deal with death. Our families didn't talk about it. It's not something that is pleasant to think about. But if you're going to be the adult in the room, take ownership of it. This is part of life. And if you go through the process, I promise you that it will not be as scary as your imagination is leading you to think that it is.
Absolutely. And I love how your work is tied to your personal story, and it speaks to the passion that drives the work that you do. As you mentioned, one of your official titles is Certified End of Life Doula. And as you mentioned, most people know of the role of a doula when it comes to birth, but not death. And honestly, before learning about your work, I had never even heard the term end of life doula or death doula, as our mutual friend Scott likes to put it. But for those listening who may not know, can you sort of explain what an end-of-life doula does and how your services differ from other death doulas who help people transition to the afterlife?
Well, an end-of-life doula is a non-medical person who works with individuals and their loved ones and provides holistic care and support and guidance and resources so that the individual who may be terminal or actively dying feels that they are being supported, and their caregivers, their loved ones, are also being supported by having someone like me with them to help guide and navigate, to help with those moments where everything is just so overwhelming, and just to have another individual who says, I understand what you're dealing with. I can share with you some tips that I learned so that maybe you're not going to be suffering so much at this point in time. But all end-of-life doulas do not do the same job. So there are a number of end-of-life doulas who work with hospice. There are end-of-life doulas like me who help people create their directive plans, final wishes, make sure that they have those difficult conversations with their loved ones to share with them what they want at the end of life. And I can go from personal experience on this one. When my mom was sick, my only goal was keeping her alive. I would move mountains. I would have traded places with her. But obviously that was not a possibility. And if I had had someone who understood the process, because what happens with hospice and palliative care is that you have a nurse or someone who is medically trained give you about an hour's worth of instruction as to how to help your loved one. It's just not enough time. And yeah, there are so many things. It's like being a deer in the headlights. And the nurses and the medical staff, they know this, and so they can just, you know, say it in their sleep. You're the family member grieving before your loved one has passed, watching helplessly, wanting to do what you can do, but feeling so overwhelmed, and it's just not a good place to be. So having someone like me to stand by you, to stand by your loved one, to be able to share that time, to be able to give you a little respite break. Those are the types of things that end-of-life doulas do. The other part of an end-of-life doula's job, which I do not do, is to actually vigil with an individual who is actively dying. I did that for my mom. I will do that for other family members, but it's too hard for me, and I'm going to be completely honest. And I would prefer to be at the beginning of the journey. I want to help you get your ducks in a row. I want you to have, you know, those conversations with your loved ones, because it isn't just about having a will or a living will. It's about having powers of attorney. It's about having people that you trust and know to assign them, and they accept that role to make decisions for you based on your own wishes as yes. to whether or not you want to have a DNR, which is a do not resuscitate. If you want to have any more treatments, or if you decide that you want comfort care, which would be hospice. So having an end-of-life doula help advocate with you for that makes so much more sense, and it makes the process much easier, even though it can be sad, and it will be, but it isn't like you're completely shifting in the wind, so to speak.
And I'm glad you broke it down, because there are a lot of misconceptions out there about what an end-of-life doula actually does. So I'm glad that you went into detail about the services you provide and also what you don't provide, because I can imagine vigiling through and helping someone transition to the other side. I can imagine that is completely draining. And like you said, you did it for, you know, a family member, and you'll do it for other family members. But just to offer that to the public, I can imagine, only just imagine how draining that would be for you. So thanks for the clarification on that. Mm-hmm. Something that really stood out to me when I visited your website was the fact that you advertise your business as an LGBTQ-friendly business. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you also completed cultural competency training to ensure that you're fully equipped to serve diverse communities. Why was it important to make that commitment so clear? And what does that mean in terms of the way you serve clients from various backgrounds?
I'm an equal opportunity supporter. I have had friends who have been in the LGBTQ community. My son is in the LGBTQ community, and I support him no matter what. Everyone should have access to every kind of care possible. Nobody should be excluded for any reason. So I know how challenging it can be for different communities, not just the LGBTQ, but also the Black community, the Asian community, the Hispanic community. We all have, it's all the same process. It's just who else is there to help guide you. And I don't think that those services should ever be excluded for anyone. They should be available to everyone, because there's just too many things that could go wrong. There are too many things that if you just had a little bit of guidance and someone to say, it's okay, you're doing great. I know it's hard right now, but it won't last forever. But your loved one will be okay. They are going to transition, but you're prepared. And so I'm here to stand with you to make sure that everybody is okay. You know, I'm not worried about any of our political things that are excluding people. I will never, ever exclude anyone. That's just not how I am.
And thank you so much for your commitment to ensuring diversity and cultural competency in your services. It's very much needed with so much exclusion going on with this current political environment. Not to get into much, you know, detail about that, but we all know what's happening and see what's happening with that. So having a service and a company such as yours go out of its way to say, hey, yes, we welcome LGBTQ, we welcome other diverse communities, that really means a lot to me and a lot of other people. So thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, timing is particularly important when it comes to end-of-life care and planning. And a lot of people, they don't know when to start the conversation or when to bring someone like you into the process. So from your perspective, when is the ideal time for a family to connect with you if they're interested in your services? I'm sure it's not best to wait until the person is already advanced in their care. But just in your own words, when is the best time for them to reach out to you for an ideal outcome?
The sooner the better. I didn't think about this, but it has pretty much come to my attention. any child that becomes an adult, the age of 18, they should have directive plans. They should have final wishes. They should also have powers of attorney chosen, because they go off to college or they go work somewhere or they move and a catastrophic event happens. You, as their parent, have no legal standing. You cannot make decisions for them. You cannot do anything at that point. And that would, as a mom, that would just absolutely devastate me personally. I know that this has happened with some other folks in our community where there have been catastrophic events that have happened to some of our 18 and 20-year-olds, and there was nothing in place. So, barring that, anybody over the age of 20, you should at least have something in place. These are living documents. They can change as life events change. And so if you are in a family, you have multiple siblings, starting this process sooner than later could avoid some of the infighting with your siblings as far as how things need to be, or you know, who is going to take responsibility for what. There are no guarantees in this life. So the sooner that you start the process, the better. And that's, you know, really the only thing I can say. I never had that conversation with my mom. And this is one of the other reasons why I'm so adamant about starting sooner than later, because of the things that had happened with her. I drove them to the hospital on Easter Sunday in 2011, and she never came home. And so the things that happened in that first week, she wasn't getting any better. She was getting sicker. They finally told her and I that there was nothing more medically that they could do for her. And within an hour or so, her oncologist came to me and told me that I had 24 hours to find a place to bring her. And I just kind of looked at him and I said, what if it takes longer than that? Oh, I'm sure you can handle it. You'll find some place. And I said, here's the thing. If it takes longer, she's not going anywhere. And I am telling you this right now. So it took us a couple of days to find a place. We didn't really have an option of letting her come home to pass away. I was concerned about what that would do to my father. And so we found a nursing home that wasn't too far away. We brought her by ambulance to the nursing home. She fell asleep. When she woke up, my dad and I were with her. And she looked at me and she said, I cannot believe you did this to me. And it tore my heart out. And I said, Mom, I can't believe I did either. But I didn't know what else to do. So I was trying to make sure that my dad was going to be okay, and I didn't know what her wishes were because we never talked about it, which right. is why it's so freaking important to talk about it. Just because you talk about it doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow. We're right. all going to live for a long time, for the most part, most of us. So, you know, like I said, gird your loins, put your big girl or boy panties on, take the bull by the horns, do the job, make the decision so that your loved ones don't have to while they are actively grieving for you. That is one of the worst things. We were planning my mom's funeral while she was actively dying. I don't recommend it. It's not a fun time, and it haunts you for a really long time afterwards. My mom's been gone for 14 years, and I still think about some of the things that I did and wish that I had been able to do them differently. So that's one of the other reasons why I want to be that advocate and that resource for someone else so they don't have to go through what I did and what my family went through.
I understand. And Janice, I'm so sorry you had to have the experience in that way. And thank you for sharing that bit of your personal story. It really does help illustrate the importance of the services that you provide. And I understand that, you know, as much as you probably wish you could go back and make some changes, having things happen the way they happened really opened up the door for you to help so many other families avoid those same types of pitfalls and crisis moments where, you know, something happens unfortunately and there's, you know, nothing written in place or discussions haven't been had. So, you know, I hate that that was your experience, but because of that, you built an entire business and company around helping other families to avoid that same, you know, type of situation that you had to go through with your family. So I salute you for taking that pain and turning it into something positive to help other families. And
Thank you. You
mentioned one of the documents, and I saw this on your website, too, where you have recently added advanced care plans to your list of services. And, you know, I think a lot of families may not even know that these types of documents exist, let alone how valuable that they can be. Can you just share a little bit about what an advanced care plan is and why documents like these are such useful tools for families and caregivers?
Well, advanced care plans, there's two different types. The directive plans are pretty much all of your assets and your financial stuff. And if you are online and have social media or you do online banking, all of that information is put into a document so that your power of attorney for your financial and or your executor of your estate knows where to go to find the answers. Now, the final wishes part of that is, where do you want to die if you have that choice? Are you terminal? Do you want medical aid in dying if it is offered in your state? Right now, there are about 12 states that offer medical aid in dying, and only two of them do not have residency requirements. So someone who only has 6 months to live and they have the finances to be able to do it, they can go out on their own terms. But they wouldn't know, your family members would not know that that was your part of your wishes if it was not in writing. And the other parts of final wishes, how do you want to be remembered, your legacy? Do you want a traditional religious funeral? Do you want a celebration of life? Do you have something else that you want? Some people get made into diamonds with some of their carbon from their cremated remains. Some people have it so that they have what they call, I just saw this recently, an Italian couple made a tree so that your ashes, however they process them, was the basis for a tree, and it gets planted somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a number of different ways. Now, it is not just cremation or burial. There are so many other resources and so many other companies that are coming into play that are giving people options on how do they want to have their ashes or have their bodies, you know, taken out. Some folks donate them to science, but if you donate it to science, when science, wherever you've taken it to, is finished with it, the family gets what's left, and then they have to decide if it's going to be buried or cremated or whatever. So final wishes are all of the other things that are not part of the financial or the asset part of your life.
And just as important. And I'm glad that you mentioned that as well, because we often focus so much on the financial aspect and the legal aspect. We forget about the, hey, what do you really want? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want a traditional burial? There's so many, you know, do you want a celebration of life? Do you want a regular funeral? so many things that we just don't take the time to ask because we don't want to have the conversations because, oh, it's about death and I don't want to have these morbid conversations. I'm even guilty of it. I told you during our one of our preliminary calls that my mom always tried to have the conversations about what she wanted and, you know, we need to talk about this. And I would be like, oh, Mom, I don't want to talk about that. But it's a good thing, especially when your parent is coming to you saying, hey, let's talk about what I want. Let them express those things because you never know when you're going to come across that time where there's a crisis, like with my mom and the COVID. You know, happened so quick. She was in the hospital and then, you know, less than 2 weeks later, she was gone. And so these crises, they spring up on you and you have little or no time to react. It's so detrimental to have a plan in place to know exactly what you're going to do, what their final wishes are. So anyway, I'm just so glad that you're on today. We're going to talk about this a little bit more. Right now, we're going to take a bit of a break. But definitely one of the biggest takeaways from this first segment that I've noticed is that planning early is just critical and prevents a lot of unnecessary stress and conflict when these difficult decisions have to be made. So anyway, guys, when we come back, we're going to get into the financial and legal side of caregiving. We're going to talk about what every family should have in place before a crisis and how to plan for long-term care without draining your savings. And we're also going to talk about where to find trusted caregiver resources in your community and how to approach palliative care, hospice care, and death doula services, all that type of stuff. And don't forget, we're going to go over some of your questions that you sent in, and we'll have Janice answer some of those. So you definitely don't want to miss what's coming up. First, let's hear from tonight's sponsor. We'll be right back.
Looking for your next car? Amazon Autos has you covered. With just a few clicks, you can shop a wide selection of new vehicles, compare prices, read reviews, and even arrange pickup or delivery, just like ordering anything else on Amazon. It's the future of car buying, simple, transparent, and all online. Backed by Amazon's trusted network and partnering with local dealerships, Amazon Autos is redefining how we shop for cars. Visit amazon.com/autos and drive into the future today.
Hi, I'm James Baller of Artist First Radio, and I would like to tell you about a fascinating new book from Crime Beat's Ron Chepsik and co-author Mike Rowe. It's titled Robin Hood of the Hood, The Life and Times of Teddy Rowe, Policy Kingpin, and it's published by Strategic Media Books. The book is a historical account of Theodore Teddy Rowe, who courageously fought the Chicago Mafia, more commonly known as the Outfit, for control of the lucrative policy racket in the Windy City. Policy, often called the numbers, is a form of illegal gambling or illegal lottery, played mostly in poor and working-class neighborhoods in the United States. In policy, a bettor attempts to pick three digits to match those that will be randomly drawn the following day. For decades, policy had been a staple in the black community, but when the white mob flexed its power in the late 1940s, many policy kings knuckled under the pressure. Not Teddy Rowe. Rowe famously told mob bosses that he'd rather die than give up control of his operation. Robin Hood of the Hood chronicles an exciting chapter of Chicago history. Go to the Kindle store at Amazon and buy it for just $2.99. For information about this book and other titles, please go to strategicmediabooks.com. That's strategicmediabooks.com.
Welcome to another broadcast of Spiritual Concerns, the Deborah Ruffini Show on Artist First Radio Network. We're live from England on Saturdays and Sundays, 3 p.m. New York, 8 p.m. London. All past shows are podcasts. Find them at artistfirst.com. I'll be your host, where issues relating to spiritual matters of concern will be largely examined and discussed. Enjoy the show.
You're back live with Dr. Andre Geary.
Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Live with Dr. Andre Geary. Hey, if you're just joining us, we're having an insightful conversation about caregiving, family dynamics, and preparing for the future with certified end-of-life doula, Janice Lombardo. Now, in the first part of the show, we talked about Janice's role as an end-of-life doula and the importance of cultural competency and when to start planning for care and how advanced care plans can bring clarity in tough situations. In this next segment, we're going to dive into a little bit of the financial and legal side of caregiving and talk about what every family should have in place before a crisis. And we're going to talk about where to find some trustworthy resources to help lighten the load for caregivers. All right, so let's jump right back in. Dennis, one of the things that I think doesn't get talked about enough is the emotional toll that caregiving takes on the caregiver themselves and also on their families. I remember growing up, my mother was the primary caregiver for my grandmother, and she suffered from schizophrenia and Alzheimer's, and she was also legally blind due to cataracts in both of her eyes. Mm. But my grandmother lived with us for many years. Mm-hmm. And so I saw and was able to experience firsthand the impact and toll it took on not just my mom, but on our entire household. My grandmother was not easy, you know. I never really remember my mom complaining, but I could just imagine the toll it took on her. And, you know, for many, it starts slowly with, you know, the doctor's appointments here, eye appointment there, but before you know it, it just consumes more and more of your time and your energy, and your whole identity gets sucked into this. So from your experience, what are the first signs a caregiver might be approaching burnout? And what can they do to protect their own mental health while they're still trying to just show up for their loved one?
You know, that is the million-dollar question. Mm-hmm. You know, I live this right now myself, and going through what my mom's 8-year cancer journey and being the sandwich generation parent, it's amazing how many things you can do with limited amount of time. It's like you go on autopilot, and I've watched some families who have siblings who all get along, and they create their charts and graphs, and you'll take this appointment, and you'll take this and bring this meal, and you'll do this bath time, and they just, you know, harmonize and make it all work. From what I have seen and experienced, that is the exception to the rule.
Right.
I don't know if that's really the case, but that's what I have seen, and that's, you know, not what I have experienced within my own family. You get to a point mentally, emotionally, and physically where you can become depressed, disengaged, you can become physically ill yourself. I have seen caregivers die before the person that they are caring for.
Yes.
That is beyond a wake-up call. There are, if you're dealing with a loved one who is over the age of 60 or 65, you have local councils on aging that you can contact to get services from, or find places, a local church. When I was caring for my mom, I contacted their church, and they brought meals once a week, and they would last a couple of days. And that was like the last 3 months that she was with us. And it was so helpful for me, because not that my father couldn't cook, but he was still working at the time. And so I needed to make sure that she was eating healthy food, and I was also providing some meals that I would make extra because I was cooking for my own family. Trying to find other resources. There are nursing students who can sometimes pitch in and help. You can pay them. There are different organizations within different cities, and you would just have to kind of do a Google search or, like I said, contact your local council on aging. There are some high school students who are doing double duty, so they're going to college to become nurses or another healthcare individual. They can also sometimes help you with either respite care or something along those lines. And because most high school students, this is in our area, I think it's everywhere, you have to volunteer a minimum of 40 hours in a year so that you can graduate from high school. This is one of the things that many high schools do. And so if you can find individuals who are already going for nursing, they can be a wonderful resource to be able to help you. So talking to your friends sometimes, not complaining, but just having, you know, a cup of tea over the phone, just so that you know that you are being validated and supported, even if somebody else can't physically be with you. There were times where I would talk to my friends at night after my kids were in bed, and I just needed an hour. That's all I needed, is somebody to just listen and to, you know, tell me that I was doing okay, and if they were able to do anything else, like either play dates for the kids or other things that might have needed help with, they were there to be able to support me in that way. It just depends on where you're at. There's also some caregiver support groups that are online. The Alzheimer's Association, if you have a loved one who has either dementia or Alzheimer's, they are not the same thing. They actually can provide you 8 hours of respite care for free, depending on where you're at. There are some assisted living and nursing home facilities that offer respite care programs. So if you wanted to drop your loved one off, I think they might have a minimum of 4 days and maybe 3 or 4 nights. But if you need to have a break, that is also an option. So there are more things coming to light because the need is being finally recognized. And I am guilty myself because I am doing this, and I have been so used to being mostly the only one making the decisions and doing the work. And so a dear friend of mine said the other week, you need to find an online support group because you need it. So I am guilty of falling back into those habits of doing it all, and it's not healthy. It's just not healthy. So the other thing that you can do is get out into nature. If you can find 5 minutes, go stand in the grass or whatever, barefoot. You can have a nice cup of coffee, listen to music, write in a journal or a diary. Just whatever it is that you can do to promote your own self-care. I know it's one more thing on your plate, but it is critical that you take care of you. You are beyond important, and it is imperative for you to be able to help anybody else to put your own oxygen mask on first.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. And it's good to know that there are, it's just good to hear that there's support out there for caregivers who often feel alone in this process. So, you know, just to recap some of the things that you touched on, there are various programs and different things that you can do. Nursing students in your local area, local agencies, even high school students that have to fulfill volunteer requirements, friends, support groups, caregiver support groups, Alzheimer's, dementia, respite care programs. Google that, look into that. Online support groups. And, you know, if all else fails, get out in nature, get out your journal, start a gratitude journal, something to reset yourself and to kind of center yourself and just find yourself again. Don't get lost in just caregiving. Just get back centered and just remember your own needs as well and refresh your own self. That way you can go back and continue to help other people as you seek to do. So very important reminders there. I want to talk about something I know is going to hit home for a lot of our listeners, and I know I've received already a number of questions surrounding this particular topic, but it's about sibling dynamics. I know in so many families, the responsibility for caring for a parent or a loved one that's aging, it always seems to fall on one sibling. And you know, while everyone loves mom and dad and grandpa and grandpa, not everyone shows up in the same way. You know, I mentioned my mother earlier. She had 7 other siblings, and I don't remember any of them offering to take their mom for the weekend, you know, to give us a break, or, hey, I'll take, you know, Kim, we called her Kim, to any of her doctor's appointments or bring meals over or anything. They just mm-hmm. sort of all just let that responsibility fall on my mom. And I'll be honest with you, seeing that, growing up, seeing that, knowing that we had a family that could have done more but just chose not to, it really mm-hmm. affected me. And it caused mm-hmm. me to have a lot of resentment towards my aunts. So how do you recommend the primary caregiver address that sort of imbalance?
Oh, that is a wonderful question. So when I was going through the process, because I'm the oldest and I'm a woman, and I'm sure that many of your listeners out there have heard about the oldest daughter syndrome. Well, mm-hmm. I actually called a siblings meeting. And when one of my mom's friends heard about that, she was like, what, is she in the mafia? So, oh my gosh. The reason that I had called the meeting was because I knew what was coming. I didn't know exactly, but I knew it wasn't going to be good, and I knew that I couldn't handle it all by myself. Mm. And I also knew that I shouldn't have to handle it all by myself. So I scheduled a family meeting. We did it in person because we were all still local at that point. I was talking about the caregiving responsibilities. I tried to set some ground rules and be respectful. And I got FaceTime of, oh, yes, we'll do this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. I wanted to bring out some of the things that needed to be done, like doctor's appointments. Because I am a medical advocate, because of everything that I have gone through, and I knew when I wasn't advocating myself, the horrible negative experiences that I had, I was not going to let my mom go through that. So when I had a better handle on when she had to go to an oncology appointment, or when she had to have a chemo appointment, or when she didn't just have cancer, she had several other conditions that were also, I'll say, fighting for attention at that point in time. And so my siblings had not been part of her care plan or her team, and I was trying to enlighten them with what was necessary. And I don't know if some of what I said was overwhelming for them, but I tried to just make it matter of fact and not put emotion into it. That's another thing that I've learned, is that when you are overly emotional, all it does is make things spiral. You got to stick to the facts. And that's one of the things that I tried really hard to do. my folks had money, so there was no real need to be concerned about financial issues at that point in time. Tried to keep the lines of communication open. Tried really hard to recognize and appreciate the differences in my siblings, what their strengths were, what their challenges would be in certain situations, so that maybe they weren't going to be signed up to do that part of the caring. Like I said, I sought outside help for meals from my parents' church, but I did not seek outside help for the caregiving part of it. I was hoping to get them to understand and focus on this being a shared goal, to help our parents and to make sure that our mom was taken care of. And the first year of her cancer journey, my two middle siblings decided that they could not participate and be part of her care plan. So they decided that they weren't going to show up. They kept the grandchildren away, which killed my mother. And it's not like my siblings were that far away. My sister was 5 miles away, and my brother was 20 houses away. So keeping things from getting out of hand, I became the solo caregiver because my third brother, or my second brother, who is the baby of the family, lived out of state, and he's still out of state. So he would talk to me, and that would be a little bit of a support for me that way, but the actual physical supporting didn't happen. So some of the things that I've learned as a solo caregiver, to find support when family isn't available, was to connect with some of the local caregiver support groups, either in person or online, researching community resources and services, the Council on Aging, United Way. I guess there is a phone dial 211 to learn about available services in your area. Exploring other relationships, building relationships with the healthcare provider. I took copious notes. I'm one of those people that if we have a conversation after we've talked and you say something and I pull out my notes, you can't really tell me that that's not what happened. So it helps to keep me on track. It would help to keep the caregiver on track, especially because when you are doing everything, you cannot remember everything. That's one of the reasons that I would take notes. Some of the other things that we would do during my mom's appointments is we would bring a little tape recorder, and we would record the appointments to listen to later, and I would transcribe them if I needed to, because it was just another way to make sure that I didn't miss anything, that something didn't fall through the cracks. One of the other things that I do, and I still do this, is I always ask, okay, you've given us this information, you've given us these things that we need to do, what else do we need to know? I cannot tell you how many times that simple question actually led to another solution for something or another resource for something. Because if you don't ask, they're not going to volunteer it, especially when you're sitting in a doctor's office and they have 15 minutes with you. And if you don't get their attention and you don't make sure they understand, you're not going anywhere until you get answers, then things fall through the cracks. And for me, that's not acceptable. And I don't do that. So I really feel that it's important for folks to know to always ask, what else do I need to know?
Very good. And I want to make sure that we leave some time on the clock for at least a few of the questions that some of the listeners sent in. But for the families who are listening, who are maybe at the beginning of this process, consider they don't have any legal paperwork, anything in place. What is the first thing they need to get done in terms of legal paperwork?
I would highly recommend creating a will. Now, if you go online, you can find all kinds of templates. LegalZoom, some of these other websites, you can create your will for free. They will sign you up for like a 7-day trial, and then you just make sure you cancel it before the 7 days is up. Well, you know, you gotta have some place to start. And so right. This way, if it is a more simple will, if you don't have a ton of assets or you don't have all kinds of, you don't have a business or you don't have something else, you can do it that way. If it's going to be much more involved, I would really recommend going to see an attorney. Now, when you see an attorney, there's going to be a flat fee, and they are going to be able to customize it to your needs and whatever it is that you have going on in your life. Now, there's one thing I want to say about this. My aunt had her will done back in 2012, and she also had power of attorney paperwork done and made it part of her will. Now, the thing is that I didn't find out until this year that the durable power of attorney paperwork that was in her will was 25 pages long. It doesn't need to be 25 pages long. I'm just letting you know, because when you're dealing with insurance companies or you're dealing with long-term care insurance and they want to make sure that you are legally her power or his power of attorney, and you send them these massive documents, and then they turn around and say, well, according to what it says in here, you have to now provide a letter from the doctor stating that this individual that you are power of attorney for has some kind of incapacitation. So either mental, physical, emotional, they can't make decisions for themselves. I found this out the hard way because I didn't know. So I'm just letting everyone know, start out with a will. Then make sure that you go and you do a living will. Hospitals used to provide those. I don't know if they still do, but you can find a template online. The next things that you would need to be was power of attorney for your health as well as for your financial, they call it a durable. My suggestion is that you have a primary power of attorney and an alternate or a secondary one. Unless, of course, you're from one of those lovely families where everybody gets along and everybody will agree and nobody at the last minute will turn around and say, no, I'm not going to do that. Make sure that you know who you are choosing for that important role. And the last thing that you would need is to choose the executor or executrix of your estate, making sure that you either have legal backup like an attorney or a financial planner, or if you're already over 60, work with an elder attorney, because there are other things that have to do with Medicaid and Medicare and other processes like that, that they will be able to navigate for you because that's what they do. They specialize in that. So that would be my recommendation. And like I said at the beginning, if you have an adult child who's over 18, they should also have a will, a living will, powers of attorney, and an executor or an executrix of an estate. They don't really have anything, but it should at least be in writing so that it covers everyone, because you do not want to be in a situation where your child is in a hospital fighting for their life and you can't help. That would just be devastating. Good. So
sounds like
I just want to make sure. Yeah, I just want to make sure everybody understands.
Understood. And so for the families out there listening who don't have any paperwork currently, get a will. Get a living will, get a power of attorney, a primary and an alternate, and name an executor or executress, I hope that I said it right,
okay.
For yourself and your child if they're 18 and up, so that you can be in a position to make sure that they receive the care that they need to, or want to receive. So we're not going to be able to get to the rest of these questions. We'll try to squeeze in one more just very quickly. There's one from Evelyn that I thought was really good, and we didn't cover this. She says, how do you navigate situations where the person you're caring for refuses help or denies they need help, even when it's clear they do?
I would recommend finding a social worker because that way they can do a home visit. They can do an assessment. I would also contact the primary caregiver of that individual if they have one. If they don't, that makes it a lot more difficult. But I would also contact the Council on Aging in your area, because they will have resources that you might be able to utilize so that you can get the help for your loved one. And believe me, I get it. That's all I'm going to say on that. I get it. But those would be my suggestions.
Well, Janice, I want to thank you again so much for your time tonight and for sharing all of this valuable insight that you've gained over the years through your experience and personal experiences. We really appreciate your time here tonight.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so happy that you are willing to talk about this because we need to. We need to talk about it a lot, make it weird, but talk about it because it is going to happen. Life is finite. We do not have a choice. So if you plan for it, it'll be much easier on yourself and on your loved ones.
Well said. Well, listen, everyone, I hope you enjoyed the show tonight, and I hope you learned something new. Be sure to tune in for the next live episode of Live with Dr. Andre Jerry. It's going to air on Wednesday, September 10th. I hope that's the right date. At 6 p.m. Eastern, second Wednesday of September. It's going to be right here during the peak of hurricane season in Puerto Rico, so I don't know how things will go, but we'll see then. But until then, everybody, take care. Have a great evening. I'll see you next time. Take care.